And it's hard for me to believe that 10 years have passed since the uprising in Tunisia exploded. That led to the overthrow of the Ben Ali government and his entourage. There are a couple of key dates, but one of them just passed. It was December 17th in 2010. And as Jim, as you mentioned, on that date, basically a fruit and vegetable salesman. He had a little cart in a town called Sidi Bouzid, which is not far from Karawan, great religious center in Tunisia. And he was arrested for not having a permit. He went to the local authorities and tried to get his cart back and try to, you know, be able to sell his stuff on the street. They said no. Not only that, they wouldn't even give him the time of day. And so in frustration, he left the place. He left the local government offices and went outside and found some inflammable material. I think it was gasoline, and lit a match. And that he immolated himself. So that's how it started. And it wasn't just in Tunisia that this revolt began, but as is relatively well known now, it would spread throughout the whole region. So here we are, 10 years on, trying to evaluate what happened, what were the strengths and weaknesses of this great revolt, referred to as the Arab Spring. In the case of Tunisia is being put forth as the only success story of the Arab Spring, given all the difficulties and the tensions in other parts of the region. The State Department talks about it, the media talks about it, the pundits talk about it, and others are less impressed. And I wanted to just give you one example, and that is of a Tunisian from the town of Kasserine. So some of you might be familiar with the name Kasserine. There was a big battle in World War II where eventually the Americans won against the Nazis, the Battle of Kasserine Pass. So this is the same town. And this is a quote from Hussein Boulagi. And what he says is, Tunisia's political success is a big lie. What happened here since the revolution, he asked. A minister came and laid down a cornerstone for an industrial zone, then nothing. So that's kind of, you know, the two approaches to this. Let's start off, Ibrahim, as someone who comes from the broader region of the Middle East and North Africa, how do you assess the Tunisian revolt of 2010 and 2011 at the time? What was your thinking then?
Well, if you remember, Jim and Rob, both of you, when we actually sat down to debate, you expressed surprise, Rob, that it has the 10 years, a decade has passed. And in the light of COVID-19 and isolation, how much we miss those days that we could travel to the studio and have a cup of coffee outside and chat before we begin the discussion. We sat and we reflected on what was happening in Tunis. We certainly were not predicting a revolution or anything else, knowing what was going on in the region. But we certainly talked about the fact that the current situation at that time in Tunisia was not sustainable, and something must happen. We never thought that within a couple of weeks, beginning of 2011, the whole Arab world is going to go up in a smoke. And so at that time, we were hopeful that something positive, that this revolt would lead to something bigger, and ultimately some positive things will come out of it. But unfortunately, this is something that during the discussion tonight, it becomes clear why it didn't happen. But before I continue, I think I want to ask you, Rob, a question. As somebody that spent a number of years in Tunis as a Peace Corps volunteer, what were your memories of Tunis? And then we will continue with my discussion regarding our assessment of the political dynamics and then why it did not take place.
And Rob, before you begin, I want to just chime in. I'm glad that Ibrahim brought that up. I had gone back and looked at, I can't believe I had some notes from that time. We were, some old
good
notes,
for you.
But we had been discussing a few months before that, the region and economic issues in different countries. And a month, I think in November, we discussed Tunisia and exactly what Ibrahim was saying. We were discussing the economic situation there and the issue of, oligarchy and so forth, the Ben Ali's family making a lot of money and so forth, and the IMF. And so I just wanted to say that it was kind of, yes, we could not have predicted, but I remember both of you saying that, this is probably not going to be sustainable. And then a month later, here we were. And then everything followed from there. But anyway, I just wanted to chime in with that and go ahead.
Well, thank you. Look, in the course of one's life, it's rare that one can be prophetic. All right.
Well,
so we came across something and we're going to talk about these issues that you raised, Jim, as we go along. But I wanted to just go back in time to those days when I was a Peace Corps volunteer and staff member in Tunisia. It's more than half a century ago. But let me say this, that those years, when I look back on them, not all that long ago, they were the formative years of my life. I don't know that I even understood what I was experiencing at the time. I was there from June of 66 to November of 68. Now, you have to remember what those years were like. This is the period of the Vietnam War. It's in full swing. During the years I was in Tunisia, Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. And so from a global point of view, this was a period of great instability. There was the uprisings of 1968 in a lot of places in the world as well. But in Tunisia at that time, these were years, frankly, of hope and dynamism. And the reason is that the country was 10 years into its post-colonial period. It won its independence in 1956 from France. And what I remember about those days among the Tunisian people was there was this wonderful spirit of nation building. This was a time of hope for the future. And it really didn't matter, at least in my case, who I spoke to. The Tunisians that I knew, whether they were my students, I taught at the University of Tunis, an annex of the University of Tunis, or whether it was the Tunisian friends I met, there was this deep sense of we're going to make this future in Tunisia, we're going to do it. Didn't matter whether they were rich or poor, and it had a very big effect on me to see that that kind of solidarity. And it was also a period of growth, national growth in the economy as well, which lasted until about 1980 when things began to slow. So and finally, Tunisia, in the same way that now that they're saying, Tunisia, it's the one success story of the Arab Spring. Before that, it was being said, Tunisia, it's the structural adjustment success story. The IMF and the World Banks, who are already being hammered for their structural adjustment policies all over the world, they were saying, but look, they were using two examples. One was Tunisia and the other was Ghana. So, Ibrahim, tell me, what happened to all that hope of Tunisia's early post-independence years?
Well, before you, I go on, even by now, once we have information that was were not available at that time, even the so-called post-independence reform and economic prosperity turned out to be concocted notion. It was the books were fixed and everything else. So I don't believe this statement in its generalities is true, but certainly to a degree during Habib Bourguiba's time was relatively better than what happens after him. But I think understand what happened and why our initial enthusiasm did not take place. We really need to understand the political dynamics of the Arab world. Arab world, since its independence, which goes through a different era, the governments in charge have never been, their legitimacy of the government has never rested on a popular support. Always the political dynamic dependent on a foreign support one way or the other. During the Cold War, the Arab world divided itself into either pro-American camp or pro-Russian Soviet Union camp. And these infighting between the two major camps created a power which really, I mean, the government at that time cared less about the popular support or the popular, any democracy, popular participation, or any of that nature. This is one of the fundamental problems that we had with the Arab world. And when we were discussing what happened in Tunis, we were hoping that this political structure is going to change. And something, it leads to something better. And this political structure, unfortunately, is the cause of the failure of the Arab Spring of post-2010 and particularly post-2011, whether it was in Tunis or it was in Libya or Egypt or Yemen or anything else. So the political dynamics of the Arab world and the fact that we have tyrannical rulers and that never cared about the popular support, and they always relied on legitimacy gained by approval from outside. In earlier time, pre-1990, it was the two camps. Then it was primarily United States, as we see them now. Whether it's the Persian Gulf Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, or any other ones, Saudi Arabia, or Lebanon, or any other country in the Middle East, their legitimacy depends on United States and the Western powers' approval of them. And this is this was missed by people who were at that time trying to assess the future of this uprising, whether it's going to succeed or it's going to fail. I have, since we have started asking each other question, Rob, I want to ask you, use this concept, the political dynamics. Although we, both of us, and I'm sure Jim as well, at that time we were hopeful that something positive will come out of it in this uprising. But your trip in 11, I remember when you came back, you were kind doom and gloom. We had lengthy conversation about Tunis, and something had happened during that visit that shifted your at least initial prediction and optimism into some degree of cynicism. Can you explain that?
Yes, I can, and I will, because that was another trip that made a pretty big impression on me. But before I do that, Ibrahim, I want to go back to what you were talking about in terms of the way that the Arab world and the whole Middle East, actually, beyond that, including Turkey and Iran, was kind of divided during the Cold War. And what I wanted to talk about briefly was the terms by which Tunisia got its independence. And there's a Tunisia was a French colony, and in the 1950s, one thing about Charles de Gaulle was Charles de Gaulle saw that independence was going to come to the French colonies, be they in Southeast Asia, be they in Africa. It really didn't matter, because he understood that given what happened in World War II, that France wasn't strong enough to hold its colonies. And not only that, that part of what World War II was about was a struggle against racism and colonialism itself. And so what he tried to craft was, how could France offer independence, if you like, to its former colonies, at least formally, while retaining control over the key elements of the newly independent countries? And so there were a lot of secret deals that were cut. And the first one is with Tunisia. And what am I referring to? That, yes, Tunisia's independence, however, its security policy, anything that Tunisia did had to be approved by France. Its economic policy could not change without French permission. And so what we have is, you know, this whole term neocolonialism, that the new colonialism, that is countries that are politically and technically free, but actually in many and really key ways continue to be controlled by their former colonial powers, be it France, the United States, or whatever. So that was one of the limitations, if you like, of Tunisian independence from the very beginning. And that model would then be applied throughout Africa and wherever else that France, quote, granted independence. So de Gaulle looks like this, you know, great liberator, if you like, of French colonialism, whereas in fact he came up with a very insidious and effective plan to maintain French control. And the guy who did it for him was named Jacques Foucart. And Jacques Foucart is kind of this eminence grise within the French administration in those days. Okay, coming back now to my trip, which was a really interesting trip. First of all, I had no intention of going back there, but we have a small Tunisian community here in Colorado, and particularly in the Denver area, and I started meeting with them shortly before the revolt took place, and they were the ones who encouraged me to why don't you go see what's going on? And so I did. And I returned. You know, the Ben Ali had been ousted from power. I believe that the key date is the 14th of January in 2011. And I spent from the middle of November to the middle of December in Tunisia. And what do I do in terms of an investigation? It's very simple. My way of doing things is pretty, unorthodox, from an academic perspective. Basically, when I talked to everybody I could find, rich, poor, everybody in between, political people, some of whom were rather high up in the new government already, to people on the street. And what emerged almost immediately, so now we're almost a year into this revolution, was that the hopefulness that we felt, it contrasted rather dramatically with the realities on the ground. And the most disturbing thing that I saw and that I experienced was there were no change in any of the institutions from the Ben Ali days. And I'm just going to cite two. One was the Ministry of Finance, and the other was the Ministry of Internal Affairs. So many of the same players were involved. There was no institutional changes. Yes, Ben Ali was gone, and the country was greatly relieved. I mean, this is a place where in the 1960s, you didn't talk politics. You talked about the weather and your family. I go back, and that's all people were talking about. So there was this new openness. But when you looked at the structures of society, they had not changed. Not only that, There were some new elements. Excuse me?
Rob, can I interject?
Sure, yes.
BBC has published few articles about reflection on the 10th anniversary, and they have interviewed a number of younger members of that uprising that participated within it in one way or the other. And they say the same thing. They say that before the Ben Ali departure, politics was out. Now you can sit down in cafes and talk about politics.
Yes.
But nothing else has changed. As a matter of fact,
right.
They were indicating that the socioeconomic crisis is, if it's not worse than what it used to be before Ben Ali's departure, it is almost the same. The role of the World Bank, the role of International Monetary Fund,
right.
And everything else, even in cases that they talk about, a number of deals that Ben Ali wasn't prepared to sign, and Nahda and others signed and gave free hand to IMF and others. So whatever your assessment of that time in 2011 is underscored by the Tunisians,
yes,
that have been interviewed by BBC during the last few weeks.
And I just want to chime in. Also, I do remember speaking,
yes,
with Rob as well. And Rob, you mentioned on this program, actually, that you know, there were many organizations were not allowed to exist, or political parties, in a sense, other than very religious parties.
During the Ben Ali years.
And
yes,
one of the downsides you said to that was that there was no, independent party or no secular parties, in a sense, very right-wing, very conservative religious parties. And you were also saying then, as Ibrahim was saying, and you said on the show, that things maybe weren't going to turn out, you know, because of the repression that had gone on for years before.
Jim, can I add something before Rob goes on?
Yeah, sure.
And that is extremely critical for why the civil society in Tunis was not able to establish itself, because the civil society had no political experience and no organization.
Right.
But these
and no voice.
And the voice, yeah. But these extreme religious organizations were well oiled, well financed, ready to jump in.
Yes, exactly.
And this is something the BBC talks about, that these guys, they're saying, none of these parties participated in the uprising, but suddenly,
right,
as soon as things settled, they were the ones that picked up everything and moved with it, and we were left behind.
Yep.
Sorry,
that's absolutely right, and that's what I saw just taking form, Ibrahim and Jim, when I was there back at the end of 2011. So on the one hand, there's this national spirit of joy. Ben Ali and his entourage is gone, having, stopped off at the National Bank and stolen all the gold on their way to Saudi Arabia. And genuine jubilation. Nothing short of that. On the other hand, all of a sudden, we begin to see, and immediately, the influence of basically these two Islamic trends, the Wahhabists from Saudi Arabia, Salafists, as they're referred to, and the other was the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood through its local chapter, which is the party that's referred to as Ennahda in Arabic, or the Renaissance Party. And it was quite clear, first of all, that these guys were foreign-funded. Foreign funded and trained and all that. And so the rest of Tunisian political society is unorganized. It was repressed and not only during the Ben Ali years, but there was some openness during the Bourguiba years, but it was also, you took things too far during the Bourguiba years, you got hit. Whether you were Ba'athists or leftists or Islamists, it really didn't matter. So we did not have a political culture. So The new period begins with the particularly the Brotherhood Party being highly organized. And where did they do most of their organizations? Was in the prisons. Was in the Tunisian prisons during those years. And the rest of society really not having, if you like, any political experience. And then you have an election where you have 15 or 20 parties, and some of which represent the five guys or this businessman over here, versus a highly organized, disciplined, foreign-trained political party. And the result really was not much of a mystery as far as I was concerned. Did you want to say something, Ibrahim?
Yeah, I said not only they were trained outside. I mean, another head lived in United Kingdom. And most of the training was done over there. But the main factor was huge amount of money that the Saudis and the Qataris and others were pouring into Tunis to influence the election. So what we had procedural kind of election on paper that people go, but
right.
They were influenced by this huge amount of money. And naturally, another won it. And they were the ones that ultimately came to power.
I'm just going to chime in just real quick to remind the listeners the time is 6:32 and they're tuned to Hemispheres and KGNU, and this is the Middle East Dialogues. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and we're, as I mentioned, doing the Middle East Dialogues with Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. And so go ahead, Rob.
Okay, I want to give you a couple of examples building on what Ibrahim said. So I'm meeting with all of these parties, you know. It was easy that people wanted to talk. I mean, it wasn't, it was, in that sense, it was this breath of fresh air. What I learned about, they're not a party at the time. One of the things they were trying to do was to get the wives of people not to go to the workplace anymore. How did they do that? They offered to pay families so that the wives would stay at home. All right, I heard that from three or four different sources. Okay, now where are they getting the money from that? Well, that money is coming from Qatar and Turkey and who knows where. That was the first point. Second point that really was even more disturbing. I sat and met with a whole bunch of Tunisian women. And they were already 8 months into this. They were really scared. There was all kinds of subterfuge. If I see you walking with some man holding hands, you know, are you wearing the scarf on your head? These kind of things. And so you could see that this and not to overstate it, but still. In Tunisia, women were integrated into the workforce. They were highly educated. You would see when I went back there. I got bronchitis a couple times. All the doctors I dealt with were women. So you begin to see this kind of Salafist Wahhabist approach to gender, and people were really nervous. A friend of mine who is a filmmaker, he actually became quite a famous filmmaker, was personally threatened by the head of the Ennahda party on Tunisian television. So the atmosphere, rather than opening up the way it often happens after a genuine revolt and revolution, you began to see already it was closing down. But the biggest point I want to make is this. All right, my teaching had to do with political economy. In third world countries, I was really excited. Oh, here was the revolt. Were they corrupt? Leadership is gone. What's the new economic program? And I would ask again whoever I spoke to. And what you learned immediately was not only was there not a new economic program, a vision for where the Tunisian economy should go, either medium term or long term. There was no thought of it whatsoever. None. This came, and the worst on that was the Ennahda party. It had no economic program. So here it is coming to power or influence, whatever you want to call it, and they don't have an economic program. Well, if they don't have an economic program, what's What is going to follow? What's going to follow is very simple. The economic program that existed before. And then all of a sudden you begin seeing the limits of what's going on here. Yes, they got rid of the bad guys. They got, you know, the corrupt leadership. But other than that, under the surface, not much was going to change. And so those were my main impressions, if you like, in those days.
But it was still...
Excuse me?
Yeah, I remember those days. In addition to what you outlined, what we saw, the repression and the assassination of opposition leadership that might have undermined or somehow created a block in front of Annahda or any other of these Wahhabi Salaf parties that were being supported. What was painful to see that despite everything, United States was in full support of Annahda.
Yes, that's correct.
They are the best, and they were providing Annahda or presenting Annahda as Annahda-led government as the best alternative or some kind of a model for the rest of the Arab world or the Muslim world. And that was a critical factor that we have to discuss it.
Yes, and so Ibrahim, I must admit, though, you know, it was unclear at the end of 2011 which way Tunisia was going to go. What I was feeling was, I would say, warning signs. So here we are now, 10 years after the revolt, 9 years after my visit there. From your perspective of somebody who comes from the region and knows the region very well, what happened and what didn't happen from what you could tell? Because from where I'm sitting, it does not look like Tunisia was the one success story of the Arab Spring. It doesn't look like that at all. Maybe one could say it was the least dramatic failure of the Arab Spring. I'm not even sure of that. So what's your take on what happened here?
Unfortunately, Rob, I mean, the question is an important question and valid. But the reason why in answer to your previous question, I said that the political dynamics of the Arab world in particular was missed, in the sense that the Arab world and the powers, the political leaders, never relied on popular support. There was no democracy or anything else, no representation. They always relied on whether they received their legitimacy from the green light received by the by United States in 2011 and previously, or the Western powers, that created the conduit by which the West, in particular the United States, was able to undermine, neutralize, and sabotage and subvert the revolution. Particularly United States, and when I say United States, that includes the Western powers as well, they created this notion of enemy friend in each of these governments. By the way, I was probably the first one, the first lecturer that organized quickly at the early part of 2011 a class on Arab Spring. Nobody else had already even thought about teaching it when I started at Corbel. Teaching, and the response was immediate. The class was full, and we debated a number of issues. One of the people and authors that I read at the time, it was Samir Amin.
Samir Amin, the great Egyptian economist. Yeah.
That lived in, I think it was in Senegal or somewhere.
In Dakar, in yes. Africa.
Yeah, Dakar. Anyway, so his assessment, which I, when I read it, I agreed with, is that when we try to understand how the Arab Spring, or the, at least the hope, was subverted, we really need to go back to this inherent approach by the Western powers regarding whether in each of these countries the uprising was taking place in a friendly country or in an enemy country or rogue state, as somebody called it. If it happened in the friendly country, United States and European powers, they did everything possible not to allow the uprising to lead to a concrete result, real substantive change in the political structure that leads to democracy. And instead, it turned into some superficial, shallow changes that we, what we call, both of us, Rob, if you remember, we were discussing this, nothing more than window dressing.
Yes.
So in the case of Tunis...
Yes.
What was it?
I said, sad but true. The more that I look at what didn't happen and try to understand it, it's a lot of change in motion, a lot of motion, but not a lot of substantive change at all. And we can come back to that later when we look at some of the particulars. So go on.
Yeah. So, in the case of Tunis, in the case of Egypt, in the case of Libya, these three countries specifically, the subversion turned the uprising into nothing more than a little bit of change that you can sit and talk about politics in cafes and between individuals, something that in the past was not permitted. You can talk, as you indicated, Rob, you could talk about weather, but no politics. But now you can sit and talk about politics, but nothing, you gain nothing from this talk because the affair is in the hand of others that supported by the Western powers. So Tunis, Libya, and Egypt clearly, through at least United States and French, depending on and the rest of the European powers, they influenced and subverted the uprising and did not allow substantive change to take place. Not to mention here the role of the Arab, particularly the Saudis, and their huge amount of money into subverting the possibility of any uprising or any concrete change. That's on one side. So if the country was within what we call friendly sphere of influence, they did everything possible for everything to remain the same apart from slight change. But if the country was in what they defined as rogue state or enemy state, they used this uprising to move it towards regime change. And we see that in Yemen, we see that, we saw that, we're still seeing that in Syria, in Iraq, in other places.
And
unfortunately,
Libya.
And Libya as well. So what happened, in none of these cases, preserving the unity of the country, but allowing it a democratic political institution, were allowed to happen in these countries. So the consequence was, despite the uprising, despite the loss of life to a degree, despite everything that people were hoping, the political, the socio-political system and the socio-economic system that were underlying the factors towards the uprising remained the same, although some shallow supervision or changes, surface area changes were allowed to take place. So literally, you run to stand still. That's the expression.
Yes.
I want to come back.
You know, Ibrahim, I want to add something to this overall picture. Even in those countries where they were considered the friendly countries, and Tunisia is one of them. I mean, Tunisia has been in the U.S., French, orbit for, or since independence for all practical purposes. But what you saw was, as this revolt took place, there were a number of organizations and figures who were looking for substantial change. What happened to them? And I want to give their names, even though for an American audience they might not mean anything. But they were really, if you like, people's heroes. One was called Shoki Belad, and the other was Mohammed Brahmi. They were both assassinated. Yes, they. So those who were moving in the direction of, well, let's talk about what kind of socioeconomic changes can take place, and that our revolt was not about what kind of Islam we should have here, and their coalitions, and these were coalitions of some strength. They were mixed. They were not secular. All right. They were a mix of people, some of whom were quite religious Muslims and others who were one degree or another, if you like, secular. So that was one thing. So you eliminate those who might actually move the country towards radical change, deep-going institutional change. They are eliminated. And, of course, later on, who is accused, and with a fair amount of evidence of this, of having been behind it, this same party we've been talking about, Muslim Brotherhood Party there. So that's number one. But the other thing had to do with a stranglehold that the World Bank and the IMF have had since 2010 on the Tunisian economy. And this gets us back to structural adjustment programs. Now, just without going through the details, the crisis in 2007 in large measure had to do with how harsh these programs had been, i.e., the World Bank will give you money, but you need to open up your economy to foreign corporate interests, among other things. You know, there's a whole program there at the expense of the domestic economy. That did not change at all. Any attempt to protect Tunisian manufacturing, Tunisian industry, from the very outset. You want money from the World Bank and the IMF, and Tunisia needed it. You can't do that. Not only that, we're going to open your economy even more. So this has been a permanent feature. Tunisia is in debt. Tunisia's in trouble. You want money, you must implement the policy, these structural adjustment policies that we're imposing upon you. That's the condition. And I see that as the failure to come up with a vision and an approach where the Tunisian economy could grow in a positive way that would frankly improve and help the entire region. That never happened. And so what we have is the same socioeconomic system that existed before 2010 exists today. So why should we expect that the social crisis, which that system caused to a very great degree, that it should be any different? And it isn't. So look, here we are now, Ibrahim, we're 10 years on. We talked a little bit about it before, but is your take that what happened in Tunisia is a success story?
Well, I think we really need to spend a little bit of time. It's an excellent question. If you look at the narratives within, say, the media in the West, immediately they take the position that it is the Arab Spring has turned into Arab winter or frozen or whatever it is, because the pundit, the framework or the criteria for success and failure in their mind purely was reduced to achieving political change. According to them, you remove this system and you establish some kind of a democratic system that popular participation, and people can participate in deciding the future of their country. If that is the only criteria, then definitely the Arab Spring has failed to achieve it. Whether it is in Tunis, we have spent about 45 minutes talking about it, whether in Libya or in Egypt or anywhere else. But nevertheless, despite the fact that Arab Spring was unable to create huge change as far as political system of the Arab, due to the fact that the political system has always been externally dependent for its survival, not internally dependent, but externally to receive legitimization from the various powers in the West, be it United States or others. So because of that, and the way these external powers have dealt with it and to subvert and neutralize it, they were not able, Arab Spring has failed to deliver the political liberalization that they were looking for, which entails the socioeconomic factors that go with it.
Yes.
Nevertheless, as you indicated, Rob, in your visit, the Arab Spring created some new positive things within the mind of particularly the youth and the younger generation within these worlds. Gone the day where the notion of political establishment and the leadership being untouchable. Now,
people isn't it?
Yes, can organize with a clear understanding that if they unite, they can make huge shift and change. We saw this a year ago in Lebanon, or 2 years ago in Lebanon. We saw it in other parts of the country, in Iraq and other places, that if they were to unite, youth now is not alienated that the fact that we cannot, or impotent that we cannot do anything. There is a degree that if they unite and structure and organize themselves, they will be able. They are energized, they are polarized, they are gradually, over the course of the 10 years, they have come to understand that they should make a change and participate within the system, so that the political goal that so far has slipped through their finger, it can be achieved again. One of the
that's really the most important thing, Ibrahim.
Yeah.
The idea that change is possible in a world where they thought it was impossible, and that they are the change if they can come to, if they can come together and unify.
Yeah.
And people in Tunisia understood that.
Yeah. Another thing that we really need to point out is that the U.S. and Western in general, and U.S.'s plan for the region, unfortunately for the U.S., it hit a dead end, collapse in Syria.
Yes.
Despite the fact that they were hoping that the Syria is going to be next Egypt or next Libya or next Tunis, the collapse of the U.S.'s plan in Syria has turned the whole thing around and put the entire plan for the Middle East in a spin. As a result of that, now during at least from 2014 onwards, a clear coherence of what we call now axis of resistance. I'm sure axis of resistance would not have had an opportunity to clearly establish itself if it wasn't for the Arab Spring and for United States thinking that they can manipulate, subvert, and neutralize the hope, the political hope of the region, and as Condoleezza Rice said in 2006, it's to form and configure a new Middle East. In Afghanistan, resistance in Afghanistan.
It's funny. It's ironic that Condoleezza Rice as I still remember it because it was so disturbing. Here, people are being slaughtered in Lebanon and in Gaza. And Condoleezza Rice is talking about this is the price we have to pay for the creation of a new Middle East. Well, there is a new Middle East, but it's quite different than she had anticipated.
Yeah, that's quite considered to be. Yeah, that I consider to be as at least one of the positive outcomes of the Arab Spring, that without Arab Spring, this would not have happened. Now, in Syria, for example, there is a huge shift, and people have become much more mature not to fall into the trap of the promises by external factors about democracy and hollow promises about democracy and everything else. So, in a nutshell, if we purely look and search for political the change to the political establishment and the dynamic, Arab Spring has failed. If we extend the scope and we look for other things, certainly Arab Spring has produced great results. I would even venture to disagree with the notion that ten years is long enough for such an uprising to be able to achieve a monumental change. It's a gradual thing, and I believe the jury is still out, and we have to see. Now, I want, as we're getting towards the end, Rob, where do we go from here?
I was just going to chime in with many of the same players in Obama's administration are back. After the Trump crew, and it seems like you know, we're going to have a sort of a Clinton-esque, a Hillary Clinton State Department in a sense.
Very much so, and you know, the folks who talk a liberal game in the name of humanitarian intervention or whatever. But think of, you know, what their model for humanitarian intervention is. It's the destruction of Libya, you know, into a militia wasteland.
Or they started it.
Yes, that's correct.
And Rob, are you surprised that, or Ibrahim, that that hasn't spread over into Tunisia as much as it could have?
What? Oh, you mean the
Libya and the, you know, just a lot of the,
Well, it has somewhat. I wouldn't say it trickled down or anything. No, you know, first of all, there have been these terrible terrorist attacks in Tunisia over the years.
Yes, there has.
There's an active mercenary group in the mountains in the west of the country. No, they have a serious problem here. But in this case, you know, Tunisia is important to the United States. Tunisia, you know, get away from the economic stuff and the nonsense about democracy, but it's what's called a lily pad. It's by a lily pad, it's, you know, kind of sitting out there in the middle of the region, and it's extremely important as a communication base. In all of North Africa. So the United States has helped. Most of the aid the United States has given Tunisia in the last year has been military aid, communication military aid to deal with it.
Well, but that's all the time we have.
It's a very fragile situation. It's very fragile. We have just scratched the surface on the kind of social problems that exist in that country today.
We're going to have to end it there, Rob. I'm sorry.
Okay, very good. All right, very good.
And yes, we only have a few seconds left before cabaret begins. So I want to thank Rob.
Take care. Happy New Year.
Yep.
Well, we'll see you next week, right?
Next week. Yes, we will. All right. It's 7 o'clock,
from the city of
and we're going to go to cabaret.
Latest information on coronavirus in the city.